Darkly Dreaming Dexter, Disc 7.
The cruise ship was off to the left. The area with all the boxes was on the right, surrounded by a chain-link fence topped with razor wire. I drove around one time on the access road, wrestling a rising tide of certainty and a swelling chorus of what sounded like college fight songs from the dark passenger. The road dead-ended at a guard booth well before I got to the containers. There was a gate with several uniformed gentlemen lounging about, and no way through without answering some fairly embarrassing questions. "Yes, officer, I wondered if I could come in and look around. You see, I thought it might be a good place for a friend of mine to slice up my sister." I cut through a line of orange cones in the middle of the road, 30 feet from the gate, and turned around, back the way I had come. The cruise ship loomed on the right now. I turned left just before I came to the bridge back to the mainland and drove into a large area with a terminal on one end and a chain-link fence on the other. The fence was gaily decorated with signs that threatened dire punishment to anyone who strayed into the area, signed by U.S. Customs. The fence led back to the main road along a large parking lot, empty at this time of night. I cruised its perimeter slowly, staring at the containers on the far side. These would be from foreign ports, needing to go through customs, access tightly controlled. It would be much too difficult for anyone to get in and out of this area, especially if they were carrying questionable loads of body parts and the like. I would either need to find a different area, or admit that chasing vague feelings dredged up from a series of taunting dreams and a scantily clad doll was a waste of time. And the sooner I admitted that, the better my chance of finding Deb. She wasn't here. There was no reason she should be. At last, a logical thought. I felt better already, and certainly would have been smug about it, if I hadn't seen a familiar panel truck parked right up against the inside of the fence, parked to display the lettering on the side that said Alonzo Brothers. My private crowd in the basement of my brain sang too loudly for me to hear myself smirk, so I pulled over and parked. The clever boy part of me was knocking on the front door of my brain and calling out, "Hurry, hurry, go, go, go!" But around back, the lizard slithered up to the window and flicked its cautious tongue, and so I sat for a long moment before I finally climbed out of the car. I walked to the fence and stood like a bit part actor in a World War II prison camp movie, my fingers locked in the mesh of the fence, peering hungrily at what lay beyond, only a few impossible yards away. I was sure that there must be a very simple way for a marvelously intelligent creature like me to get in, but it was some indication of the state I was in that I couldn't seem to fasten one thought onto another. I had to get in, but I couldn't. And so I stood there, clinging to the fence and looking in, knowing full well that everything that mattered was right there, only a few yards away, and I was completely unable to fling my giant brain at the problem and catch a solution as it bounced back. The mind picks some very bad times to take a walk, doesn't it? My backseat alarm clock went off. I had to move away, and right now. I was standing suspiciously in a well-guarded area, and it was night. Any moment, one of the guards was certain to take an interest in the handsome young man peering intelligently through the fence. I would have to move on and find some way in as I rolled along in my car. I stepped back from the fence, giving it one last loving look. Right there, where my feet had touched the fence, a break was barely visible. The fence links had been snipped just enough to allow entry for one human being, or even a good copy like me. The flap was pinned in place by the weight of the parked truck, so it wouldn't swing out and give itself away. It must have been done recently, this evening, since the truck had arrived. My final invitation. I backed away slowly, feeling an automatic "hello there" kind of absent-minded smile climb up on my face as a disguise. "Hello there, officer. Just out for a walk. Lovely evening for a dismemberment, isn't it?" I cheerfully scuffed over to my car, looking around at nothing but the moon over the water, whistling a happy tune as I climbed in and drove away. No one seemed to be paying any attention whatsoever, except, of course, for the hallelujah chorus in my mind. I nudged my car into a parking place over by the cruise ship office, perhaps 100 yards from my little handmade gate into paradise. A few other cars were scattered nearby. No one would pay any mind to mine. But as I parked, another car slid into the spot next to me, a light blue Chevy with a woman behind the wheel. I sat still for a moment. So did she. I opened my door and got out. So did Detective LaGuerta. Chapter 25. I've always been very good at awkward social situations, but I must admit that this one had me stumped. I just didn't know what to say, and for a moment I stared at LaGuerta, and she looked back at me with her eyes unblinking and her fangs slightly exposed, like a predatory feline trying to decide whether to play with you or eat you. I could think of no remark that didn't begin with a stammer, and she seemed interested only in watching me. So we simply stood there for a long moment. At last, she broke the ice with a light quip. "What's in there?" she asked, nodding toward the fence, some 100 yards away. "Why, detective," I gushed, hoping that she wouldn't notice what she had said, I suppose. "What are you doing here?"
"I followed you. What's in there?"
"In there?" I said. I know, a really dumb remark, but honestly, I had just about run out of the smart ones, and I can't be expected to come up with something good under such circumstances. She cocked her head to one side and poked her tongue out, letting it run along her bottom lip. Slowly to the left, right, left, and back into her mouth again. Then she nodded.
"You must think I'm stupid," she said.
And, of course, that thought had crossed my mind fleetingly once or twice, but it didn't seem politic to say so.
"But you got to remember," she went on, "I'm a full detective, and this is Miami. How do you think I got that, huh?"
"Your looks?" I asked, giving her a dashing smile. It never hurts to compliment a woman. She showed me her lovely set of teeth, even brighter in the high crime lights that lit up the parking area.
"That's good," she said,
and she moved her lips into a strange half-smile that hollowed her cheeks and made her look old.
"That's the kind of shit I used to fall for when I thought you liked me."
"I do like you, detective," I told her, perhaps a little too eagerly. She didn't seem to hear me.
"But then you push me on the floor like I'm some kind of pig, and I wonder what's wrong with me. I got bad breath, and it hits me. It's not me. It's you. There's something wrong about you."
Of course, she was right, but it still hurt to hear her say so. "I don't... What do you mean?" She shook her head again. "Sergeant Doakes wants to kill you, and he doesn't even know why. I should have listened to him. Something is wrong about you, and you're connected to this hooker stuff some way." "Connected? What do you mean?" This time there was an edge of savage glee to the smile she showed me, and the trace of an accent snuck back into her voice.
"You can save the cute acting for your lawyer, and maybe a judge, 'cause I think I got you now."
She looked at me for a long, hard moment, and her dark eyes glittered. She looked as inhuman as I am, and it made a small shiver run across the back of my neck. Had I truly underestimated her? Was she really this good? "And so you followed me?" More teeth.
"That's right, yeah," she said.
"Why are you looking around at the fence? What's in there?" I am sure that under ordinary circumstances, I would have thought of this before, but I pled duress. It truly didn't occur to me until that very moment, but when it did, it was like a small and painful light flashing on.
"When did you pick me up?
At my house? At what time?"
"Why do you keep changing the subject? Something's in there, huh? Detective, please. This could be very important. When and where did you start to follow me? She studied me for a minute, and I began to realize that I had, in fact, underestimated her. There was a great deal more to this woman than political instinct. She really did seem to have something extra. I was still not convinced that any of it was intelligence, but she did have patience, and sometimes that was more important than smarts in her line of work. She was willing to simply wait and watch me and keep repeating her question until she got an answer. And then she would probably ask the same question a few more times, wait and watch some more to see what I would do. Ordinarily, I could outwit her, but I couldn't possibly outwait her, not tonight. So I put on my best humble face and repeated myself. Please, detective. She stuck her tongue out again and then finally put it away. Okay, she said. When your sister was gone for a few hours and no word where, I started to think maybe she's up to something. And I know she can't do anything herself, so where would she go? She arched an eyebrow at me, then continued in a triumphant tone. To your place, that's where, to talk with you. She bobbed her head, pleased with her deductive logic. And so I think about you for a while. How you're always showing up and looking, even when you don't have to. How you figure out those serial killers sometimes, except this one. And then how you fuck me over with that stupid list, make me look stupid, push me on the fucking floor. Her face looked harder, a little older again for a moment. Then she smiled and went on. I said something out loud in my office, and Sergeant Doak says, I told you about him, but you don't listen. And all of a sudden, it's your big, handsome face all over the place, and it shouldn't be. She shrugged. So I went to your place, too. When? At what time? Did you notice? Nah, she says. But I'm only there like 20 minutes, and then you come out and play with your faggot Barbie doll, and then drive over here. 20 minutes. So she hadn't been there in time to see who or what had taken Deborah. And quite probably, she was telling the truth and had simply followed me to see... to see what? But why follow me at all? She shrugged. You're connected to this thing. Maybe you didn't do it, I don't know. But I'm going to find out. And some of what I find is going to stick to you. What's in there, in those boxes? You going to tell me, or are we just going to stand here all night? In her own way, she had put her finger right on it. We couldn't stand here all night. We couldn't, I was sure, stand here much longer at all before terrible things happened to Deborah. If they hadn't already happened. We had to go, right now. Go find him and stop him. But how did I do that with LaGuerta along for the ride? I felt like a comet with a tail I didn't want. I took a deep breath. Rita had once taken me to a New Age health awareness workshop, which had stressed the importance of deep cleansing breaths. I took one. I didn't feel any cleaner after my breath, but at least it made my brain whirl into brief action, and I realized I would have to do something I had rarely done before. Tell the truth. LaGuerta was still staring at me, waiting for an answer. I think the killer is in there, I told LaGuerta. And I think he has Officer Morgan. She watched me for a moment without moving. Okay, she said at last. And so you come stand at the fence and look in. Because you love your sister so much you want to watch? Because I wanted to get in. I was looking for a way in through the fence. Because you forgot that you work for the police? Well, there it was, of course. She had actually jumped right to the real problem spot. And all by herself, too. I had no good answer for that. This whole business of telling the truth just never seems to work without some kind of awkward unpleasantness. I wanted to be sure before I made a big fuss. She nodded. Uh-huh, that's really good, she said. But I tell you what I think. Either you did something bad, or you know about it. And you're either hiding it, or you want to find it by yourself. By myself? But why would I want that? She shook her head to show how stupid that was. So you get all the credit, You and that sister of yours. Think I didn't figure that out? I told you, I'm not stupid.
I'm not your slasher detective, I said, throwing myself on her mercy and now completely confident that she had even less than I did. But I think he's in there, in one of the storage boxes.
She licked her lips. Why do you think that?
I hesitated, but she kept her unblinking lizard stare on me. As uncomfortable as it made me, I had to tell her one more piece of truth. I nodded at the Alonzo brothers' van parked just inside the fence.
That's his truck.
Ha, she said, and at last she blinked. Her focus left me for a moment and seemed to wander away into some deep place. Her hair? Her makeup? Her career? I couldn't tell. But there were a lot of awkward questions a good detective might have asked here. How did I know that was his truck? How had I found it here? Why was I so sure he hadn't simply dumped the truck and gone somewhere else? But in the final analysis, LaGuerta was not a good detective. She simply nodded, licked her lips again, and said, "How are we going to find him here and all that?"
Clearly, I really had underestimated her. She had gone from you to we with no visible transition.
"Don't you want to call for backup?" I asked her. "This is a very dangerous man." I admit I was only needling her, but she took it very seriously.
"If I don't catch this guy by myself, in 2 weeks I'm a meter maid," she said.
"I got my weapon. Nobody's going to get away from me. I'll call for backup when I have him." She studied me without blinking.
"And if he's not in there, I'll give them you."
It seemed like a good idea to let that go. "Can you get us through the gate?"
She laughed.
"Of course I can. I got my badge. Get us through anywhere."
"And then what?"
This was the tricky part. If she went for this, I might well be home free. "Then we split up and search until we find him." She studied me. Again, I saw in her face the thing I had seen when she first got out of her car. The look of a predator weighing her prey, wondering when and where to strike, and how many claws to use. It was horrible. I actually found myself warming to the woman.
"Okay," she said at last, and tilted her head toward her car. "Get in."
I got in. She drove us back out onto the road and over to the gate. Even at this hour, there was some traffic. Most of it seemed to be people from Ohio looking for their cruise ship, but a few of them wound up at the gate, where the guards sent them back the way they came. Detective LaGuerta cut ahead of them all, bulling her big Chevy to the front of the line. Their Midwest driving skills were no match for a Miami Cuban woman with good medical insurance driving a car she didn't care about. There was a blare of horns and some muffled shouting, and we were at the guard booth. The guard leaned out, a thin, muscular black man.
"Lady, you can't..."
She held up her badge.
"Police, open the gate."
She said it with such hard-edged authority that I almost jumped out of the car to open the gate myself. But the guard froze, took a breath through his mouth, and glanced nervously back into the booth.
"What you want with..."
"Open the fucking gate, rental," she told him, jiggling her badge, and he finally unfroze. "Let me see the badge," he said. LaGuerta held it up limply, making him take the extra step over to peer at it. He frowned at it and found nothing to object to.
"Uh-huh," he said. "Can you tell me what you want in there?"
"I can tell you that if you don't open the gate in 2 seconds, I'm going to put you in the trunk of my car and take you downtown to a holding cell full of gay bikers, and then I'm going to forget where I put you."
The guard stood up.
"Just trying to help," he said, and called over his shoulder.
"Tavio, open the gate."
The gate went up, and LaGuerta gunned her car through.
"Son of a bitch got something going he doesn't want me to know about," she said.
There was amusement in her voice to go with the rising edge of excitement.
"But I don't care about smuggling tonight."
She looked at me.
"Where are we going?"
"I don't know," I said. "I guess we should start over where he left his truck." She nodded, accelerating down the path between stacks of storage boxes.
"If he's got a body to carry, he probably parked pretty close to wherever he was going."
As we got closer to the fence, she slowed down, nosing the car quietly to within 50 feet of the truck and then stopping.
"Let's take a look at the fence,"
she said, slamming the transmission into park and sliding out of the car as it rocked to a stop. I followed. LaGuerta stepped in something she didn't like and lifted her foot to look at her shoe. "God damn it," she said. I moved past her, feeling my pulse hammering loud and fast, and went to the truck. I walked around it, trying the doors. They were locked, and although there were two small back windows, these were painted over from the inside. I stood on the bumper and tried to peek in anyway, but there were no holes in the paint job. There was nothing more to be seen on this side, but I squatted anyway and looked on the ground. I felt, rather than heard, LaGuerta slither up behind me. "What you got?" she asked, and I stood. "Nothing," I said. "The back windows are painted over on the inside."
"Can you see in the front?"
I went around to the front of the truck. It was bare of any hint as well. Inside the windshield, a pair of the sunscreens so popular in Florida had been unfolded across the dashboard, blocking out any possible view into the cab. I climbed on the front bumper and up onto the hood, crawled along it from right to left, but there were no gaps in the sunscreen. "Nothing," I said, and climbed down.
"Okay," LaGuerta said,
looking at me with lidded eyes and just the smallest tip of her tongue protruding.
"Which way you want to go?"
"This way," someone whispered deep inside my brain.
"Over here."
I glanced to the right, where the chuckling mental fingers had pointed, and then back to LaGuerta, who was staring at me with her unblinking, hungry tiger stare.
"I'll go left and circle around," I said. "Meet you halfway."
"Okay," LaGuerta said with a feral smile. "But I go left." I tried to look surprised and unhappy, and I suppose I managed a reasonable facsimile, because she watched me and then nodded.
"Okay,"
she repeated, and turned down the first row of stacked shipping containers. Then I was alone with my shy interior friend. And now what? Now that I had tricked LaGuerta into leaving me the right-hand path, what did I do with it? After all, I had no reason to think it was any better than the left hand, or, for that matter, better than standing by the fence and juggling coconuts. There was only my sibilant interior clamor to direct me, and was that really enough? When you are an icy tower of pure reason, as I have always been, you naturally look for logical hints to direct your course of action. Just as naturally, you ignore the non-objective, irrational screeching of loud musical voices from the bottom floor of your brain that try to send you reeling along the path, no matter how urgent they have become in the rippling light of the moon. And as to the rest, the particulars of where I should go now, I looked around, down the long, irregular rows of containers. Off to the side, where LaGuerta had gone spike-heeling along, there were several rows of brightly colored truck trailers. And in front of me, stretching off to the right, were the shipping containers. Suddenly, I was very uncertain. I didn't like the feeling. I closed my eyes. The moment I did, the whispering became a cloud of sound, and without knowing why, I found myself moving toward a clutter of shipping containers down near the water. I had no conscious notion that these particular containers were any different or better, or that this direction was more proper or rewarding. My feet simply jerked into motion, and I followed them. It was as if they were tracing some path only the toes could see, or as if some compelling pattern was being sung by the whisper wail of my internal chorus, and my feet translated and dragged me along. As they moved, the sound grew inside me, a muted, hilarious roar, pulling me faster than my feet, yanking me clumsily down the crooked path between boxes with powerful, invisible jerks. And yet at the same time, a new voice, small and reasonable, was pushing me backward, telling me I didn't want to be here of all places, yammering at me to run, go home, get away from this place. And it made no more sense than any of the other voices. I was pulled forward and pushed back at the same time so powerfully that I couldn't make my legs work properly, and I stumbled and fell flat-faced onto the hard, rocky ground. I rose to my knees, mouth dry and heart pounding, and paused to finger a rip in my beautiful Dacron bowling shirt. I pushed my fingertip through the hole and wiggled it at myself.
Hello, Dexter. Where are you going?
Hello, Mr. Finger.
I don't know,
but I'm almost there.
I hear my friends calling.
And so I climbed to suddenly unsteady feet and listened. I heard it clearly now, even with my eyes open, and felt it so strongly I couldn't even walk. I stood for a moment, leaning against one of the containers. A very sobering thought, as if I needed one. Something nameless was born in this place. Something that lived in the darkest hidey hole of the thing that was Dexter. And for the first time that I could remember, I was scared. I didn't want to be here where horrible things lurked. Yet I had to be here to find Deborah. I was being ripped in half by an invisible tug of war. I felt like Sigmund Freud's poster child, and I wanted to go home and go to bed. But the moon roared in the dark sky above me. The water howled along Government Cut, and the mild night breeze shrieked over me like a convention of banshees, forcing my feet forward. And the singing swelled within me like some kind of gigantic mechanical choir, urging me on, reminding me of how to move my feet, pushing me lock-kneed down the rows of boxes. My heart hammered and yammered. My short gasps of breath were much too loud. And for the first time I could remember, I felt weak, woozy, and stupid, like a human being, like a very small and helpless human being. I staggered along the strangely familiar path on borrowed feet until I could stagger no more, and once again I put an arm out to lean against a box with an air conditioning compressor attached, pounding away at the back and mixing with the shriek of the night, all thumping in my head so loudly now that I could hardly see. And as I leaned against the box, the door swung open. The inside of the box was lit by a pair of battery-powered hurricane lamps. Against the back wall, there was a temporary operating table made of packing crates. And held unmoving in place on the table was my dear sister, Deborah.
Chapter 26. For a few seconds, it didn't really seem necessary to breathe. I just looked. Long, slick strands of duct tape wrapped around my sister's arms and legs. She wore gold lamé hot pants and a skimpy silk blouse tied above her navel. Her hair was pulled back tight, her eyes were unnaturally wide, and she breathed rapidly through her nose, since her mouth, too, was held closed by a strip of duct tape that went across her lips and down to the table to hold her head still. I tried to think of something to say, but realized my mouth was too dry to say it, and so I just looked. Deborah looked back. There were many things in her eyes, but the plainest was fear, and that held me there in the doorway. I had never seen that look on her before, and I was not sure what to think about it. I took half a step toward Deborah, and she flinched against the duct tape. Afraid? Of course, but afraid of me? I was here to rescue her, most likely. Why should she be afraid of me? Unless... had I done this? During my little nap earlier this evening, what if Deborah had arrived at my apartment, as scheduled, and found my dark passenger behind the wheel of the Dexter Mobile? And unknown to me, I had brought her here and taped her so tantalizingly to the table without consciously realizing it. Which made absolutely no sense, naturally. Had I raced home and left myself the Barbie doll, then gone upstairs and flopped on the bed and woke up as me again, like I was running some kind of homicidal relay race? Impossible. But how else had I known to come here? I shook my head. There was no way I could have picked this one cold box out of all the places in Miami, unless I already knew where it was. And I did. The only way that could be possible was if I had been here before. And if not tonight with Deb, then when and with whom?
I was almost sure this was the right spot, a voice said. A voice so very like my own that for a moment I thought I had said it, and I wondered what I meant by that. The hair went up on the back of my neck, and I took another half step toward Deborah, and he came forward out of the shadow. The soft light of the lanterns lit him up, and our eyes met. For a moment the room spun back and forth, and I didn't quite know where I was. My sight shifted between me at the door and him at the small makeshift work table. And I saw me seeing him, then I saw him seeing me. In a blinding flash, I saw me on the floor, sitting still and unmoving, and I didn't know what that vision meant. Very unsettling. And then I was myself again, although I was somewhat uncertain what that meant.
Almost sure, he said again, a soft and happy voice like Mr. Rogers' troubled child. But now here you are, so this must be the right place, don't you think?
There is no pretty way for me to say this, but the truth is, I stared at him with my mouth hanging open. I am quite sure I was almost drooling. I just stared. It was him. There was no question about it. Here was the man in the pictures we had found on the webcam, the man both Deb and I had thought might very well be me. This close, I could see that he was not, in fact, me. Not quite. And I felt a small wave of gratitude at that realization. Hooray. I was someone else. I wasn't completely crazy yet. Seriously antisocial, of course, and somewhat sporadically homicidal. Nothing wrong with that. But not crazy. There was somebody else, and he was not me. Three cheers for Dexter's brain. But he was very much like me. Perhaps an inch or two taller, thicker through the shoulders and chest, as though he had been doing a great deal of heavy weightlifting. That, combined with the paleness of his face, made me think that he might have been in prison recently. Behind the pallor, though, his face was very similar to mine. The same nose and cheekbones, the same look in the eyes that said the lights were on, but nobody was home. Even his hair had that same awkward half-wave to it. He didn't really look like me, but very similar. "Yes," he said. "It is a bit of a shock the first time, isn't it?"
"Just a little," I said. "Who are you? And why is all this so..." I left it unfinished, because I didn't know what all this was. He made a face. A very Dexter disappointed face. "Oh, dear. And I was so sure you had it figured out."
I shook my head. "I don't even know how I got here," I said.
He smiled softly. "Somebody else driving tonight?"
As the hair stood up on the back of my neck, he chuckled just a little, a mechanical sound that was not worth mentioning, except that the lizard voice from the underside of my brain matched it note for note.
"And it isn't even a full moon, is it?"
"But not actually an empty moon," I said. Hardly great wit, but some kind of attempt, which, under the circumstances, seemed significant. And I realized that I was half drunk with the realization that here at last was someone who knew. He wasn't making idle remarks that coincidentally stabbed into my own personal bullseye. It was his bullseye, too. He knew. For the first time, I could look across the gigantic gulf between my eyes and someone else's and say without any kind of worry, "He is like me." Whatever it was that I was, he was one too. "But seriously," I said, "who are you?" His face stretched into a Dexter the Cheshire Cat smile. But because it was so much like my own, I could see there was no real happiness behind it.
What do you remember from before? He said. And the echo of that question bounced off the container's walls and nearly shattered my brain. Chapter 27. What do you remember from before? Harry had asked me. Nothing, Dad. Except... Images tugged at my underbrain. Mental pictures. Dreams. Memories. Very clear visions, whatever they were. And they were here. This room? No. Impossible. This box couldn't have been here very long, and I had certainly never been in it before. But the tightness of the space, the cool air flowing from the thumping compressor, the dim light, everything called out to me in a symphony of homecoming. Of course, it hadn't been this same box, but the pictures were so clear, so similar, so completely almost right, except for... I blinked. An image fluttered behind my eyes. I closed them. And the inside of a different box jumped back out at me. There were no cartons in this other box, and there were things over there. Over by... Mommy? I could see her face there, and she was somehow hiding and peeking up over the things, just her face showing, her unwinking, unblinking, unmoving face. And I wanted to laugh at first, because Mommy had hidden so well. I couldn't see the rest of her, just her face. She must have made a hole in the floor. She must be hiding in the hole and peeking up. But why didn't she answer me now that I saw her? Why didn't she even wink? And even when I called her really loud, she didn't answer, didn't move, didn't do anything but look at me. And without Mommy, I was alone. But no, not quite alone. I turned my head and the memory turned with me. I wasn't alone. Someone was with me. Very confusing at first, because it was me, but it was someone else. But it looked like me. But we both looked like me. But what were we doing here in this box? And why wasn't Mommy moving? She should help us. We were sitting here in a deep puddle of... Mommy should move. Get us out of this... Blood, I whispered. You remembered, he said behind me. I'm so happy. I opened my eyes. My head was pounding hideously. I could almost see the other room superimposed on this one. And in this other room, Tiny Dexter sat right there. I could put my feet on the spot. And the other me sat beside me. But he wasn't me, of course. He was some other someone. A someone I knew as well as myself. A someone named... Biney? I said hesitantly. The sound was the same, but the name didn't seem quite right. He nodded happily. That's what you called me. At the time, you had trouble saying Brian. You said Biney. He patted my hand. That's all right. It's nice to have a nickname. He paused, his face smiling, but his eyes locked onto my face. Little brother. I sat down. He sat next to me. What? Was all I could manage to say. Brother, he repeated. Irish twins. You were born only 1 year after me. Our mother was somewhat careless. His face twisted into a hideous, very happy smile. In more ways than one, he said. I tried to swallow. It didn't work. He, Brian, my brother, went on. I'm just guessing with some of this, he said. But I had a little time on my hands, and when I was encouraged to learn a useful trade, I did. I got very good at finding things with the computer. I found the old police files. Mommy Dearest hung out with a very naughty crowd. In the import business, just like me. Of course, their product was a little more sensitive. He reached behind him into a carton and pulled out a handful of hats with a springing panther on them. My things are made in Taiwan. Theirs came from Colombia. My best guess is that Mumsy and her friends tried a little independent project with some product that, strictly speaking, didn't actually belong to her. And her business associates were unhappy with her spirit of independence and decided to discourage her. He put the hats carefully back in the carton, and I felt him looking at me. But I couldn't even turn my head. After a moment, he looked away. "They found us here," he said. "Right here." His hand went to the floor and touched the exact spot where the small other not me had been sitting in that long-ago other box. 2.5 days later, stuck to the floor in dried blood, 1 inch deep. His voice here was grating, horrible. He said that awful word, blood, just the way I would have said it, with contemptuous and utter loathing. According to the police reports, there were several men here, too, probably 3 or 4. One or more of them may well have been our father. Of course, the chainsaw made identification very difficult. But they are fairly sure there was only one woman, our dear old mother. You were 3 years old. I was 4. But, I said, nothing else came out. Quite true, Brian told me. And you were very hard to find, too. They're so fussy with adoption records in this state. But I did find you, little brother. I did, didn't I? Once again, he patted my hand, a strange gesture I had never seen from anyone in my life. Of course, I had never before seen a flesh-and-blood sibling, either. Perhaps hand-patting was something I should practice with my brother, or with Deborah. And I realized with a small flutter of concern that I had forgotten all about Deborah. I looked over at her, some 6 feet away, all neatly taped into place. "She's fine," my brother said. "I didn't want to begin without you." It may seem a very strange thing for my first coherent question, but I asked him, "How did you know I would want to?" Which perhaps made it sound as though I truly did want to. And of course, I didn't really want to explore Deborah. Certainly not. And yet, here was my big brother, wanting to play. Surely a rare enough opportunity. More than our ties of mutual parent, far more, was the fact that he was like me. "You couldn't really know," I said, sounding far more uncertain than I would have thought possible. "I didn't know," he said, "but I thought there was a very good chance. The same thing happened to both of us." His smile broadened and he lifted a forefinger into the air. "The traumatic event. You know that term? Have you done any reading on monsters like us?" "Yes," I said. "And Harry, my foster father. But he would never say exactly what happened." Brian waved a hand around at the interior of the little box. "This happened, little brother. The chainsaw, the flying body parts, the blood." With that same fearful emphasis again. 2.5 days of sitting in the stuff. A wonder we survived at all, isn't it? Almost enough to make you believe in God. His eyes glittered, and for some reason or other, Deborah squirmed and made a muffled noise. He ignored her. "They thought you were young enough to recover. I was just a bit over the age limit. But we both suffered a classic traumatic event. All the literature agrees. It made me what I am. And I had a thought that it might do the same for you." "It did," I said. "Exactly the same.
Isn't that nice?
He said. Family ties. I looked at him. My brother. That alien word. If I had said it aloud, I am sure I would have stuttered. It was utterly impossible to believe. And even more absurd to deny it. He looked like me. We liked the same things. He even had my wretched taste in jokes. I shook my head.
Yes, he said.
It takes a minute to get used to the idea that there are two of us, doesn't it? Perhaps slightly longer, I said. I don't know if I... Oh, dear. Are we being squeamish after what happened?
2.5 days of sitting here, Bubba. 2 little boys sitting for 2.5 days in blood,
he said. And I felt sick, dizzy, heart floundering, head hammering.
No,
I gagged, and I felt his hand on my shoulder. It doesn't matter, he said. What matters is what happens now.
What happens?
I said.
Yes, what happens now.
He made a small, strange, snuffling, gurgling noise that was surely intended to sound like laughter, but perhaps he had not learned to fake it as well as I had.
I think I should say something like, "My whole life has been leading up to this."
He repeated the snuffling sound. Of course, neither one of us could manage that with real feeling. After all, we can't actually feel anything, can we? We've both spent our lives playing a part, moving through this world, reciting lines, and pretending we belong in a world made for human beings, and never really human ourselves. And always, forever, reaching for a way to feel something. Reaching, little brother, for a moment just like this. Real, genuine, unfaked feeling. It takes your breath away, doesn't it?
And it did.
My head was whirling, and I didn't dare to close my eyes again for fear of what might be waiting there for me. And far worse, my brother was right beside me, watching me, demanding that I be myself, be just like him. And to be myself, to be his brother, to be who I was, I had to... What? My eyes turned, all by themselves, toward Deborah.
Yes,
he said, and all the cold, happy fury of the dark passenger was in his voice now.
I knew you'd figure it out. This time, we do it together, he said.
I shook my head, but not very convincingly.
I can't, I said.
You have to, he said. And we were both right. The feather touch on my shoulder again, almost matching the push from Harry that he could never understand, and yet seemed every bit as powerful as my brother's hand, as it lifted me to my feet and pushed me forward. 1 step. 2. Deborah's unblinking eyes were locked onto mine, but with that other presence behind me, I couldn't tell her that I was certainly not going to...
Together, he said. 1 more time. Out with the old, in with the new. Onward, upward, inward.
Another half step. Deborah's eyes were yelling at me, but he was beside me now, standing with me, and something gleamed in his hand. 2 somethings. 1 for all, 2 for 1. Did you ever read The 3 Musketeers? He flipped 1 knife into the air. It arced up and into his left hand. And he held it out toward me. The weak, dim light grew on the flat of the blades he held up and burned into me, matched only by the gleam in Brian's eyes.
Come on, Dexter, little brother, take the knife.
His teeth shone like knives.
Showtime.
Deborah, in her tightly wrapped tape, made a thrashing sound. I looked up at her. There was frantic impatience in her eyes, and a growing madness, too.
Come on, Dexter. Was I really thinking of doing this to her? Cut her loose and let's go home. Okay, Dexter? Dexter.
Hello, Dexter.
It is you, isn't it?
And I didn't know.
Dexter, Brian said. Of course I don't mean to influence your decision, but ever since I learned I had a brother just like me, this is all I could think about.
And you feel the same. I can see it in your face.
Yes, I said, still not taking my eyes off Deb's very anxious face.
But does it have to be her?
Why not her? What is she to you?
What indeed?
My eyes were locked onto Deborah's. She was not actually my sister.
Not really.
Not a real relation of any kind. Not at all.
Of course, I was very fond of her, but...
But what?
Why did I hesitate?
Of course, the thing was impossible. I knew it was unthinkable, even as I thought it.
Not just because it was Deb.
Although it was, of course. But such a strange thought came into my poor, dismal, battered head, and I could not bat it away. What would Harry say? And so I stood, uncertain, because no matter how much I wanted to begin, I knew what Harry would say. He had already said it. It was unchangeable Harry truth.
Chop up the bad guys, Dexter. Don't chop up your sister.
But Harry had never foreseen anything like this. How could he? He had never imagined when he wrote The Code of Harry that I would be faced with a choice like this. To side with Deborah, not my real sister, or to join my authentic, 100% real live brother in a game that I so very much wanted to play. And Harry could not have conceived that when he set me on my path. Harry had never known that I had a brother who would... But wait a moment. Hold the phone, please. Harry did know. Harry had been there when it happened, hadn't he? And he had kept it to himself. Never told me I had a brother. All those lonely, empty years when I thought I was the only me there was. And he knew I was not. Knew and hadn't told me. The most important single fact about me. I was not alone. And he had kept it from me. What did I really owe Harry now, after this fantastic betrayal? And more to the immediate point, what did I owe this squirming lump of animal flesh quivering beneath me, this creature masquerading as my sibling? What could I possibly owe her in comparison to my bond with Brian, my own flesh, my brother, a living replication of my self-same precious DNA? A drop of sweat rolled across Deborah's forehead and into her eye. She blinked at it frantically, making ugly squinting faces in an effort to keep watching me and clear the sweat out of her eye at the same time. She really looked somewhat pathetic, helplessly taped and struggling like a dumb animal. A dumb human animal. Not at all like me, like my brother. Not at all clever, clean, no-mess, bloodless, razor-sharp, moon-dancer, snicker-sneed Dexter and his very own brother. Well, he said, and I heard impatience, judgment, the beginning of disappointment. I closed my eyes. The room dove around me, got darker, and I couldn't move. There was Mommy watching me, unblinking. I opened my eyes. My brother stood so close behind me I could feel his breath on my neck. My sister looked up at me, her eyes as wide and unblinking as Mommy's. And the look she gave me held me, as Mommy's had held me. I closed my eyes. Mommy. I opened my eyes. Deborah. I took the knife. There was a small noise and a rush of warm wind came into the cool air of the box. I spun around. La Guerta stood in the doorway, a nasty little automatic pistol in her hand.
I knew you'd try this, she said. I should shoot you both. Maybe all three, she said, glancing at Deborah, then back at me. Ha! She said, looking at the blade in my hand. Sergeant Doak should see this. He was right about you. And she pointed the gun toward me, just for half a second. It was long enough. Brian moved fast, faster than I would have thought possible. Still, La Guerta got off one shot, and Brian stumbled slightly as he slid the blade into La Guerta's midsection. For a moment, they stood like that, and then both of them were on the floor, unmoving. A small pool of blood began to spread across the floor, the mingled blood of them both, Brian and La Guerta. It was not deep, it didn't spread far, but I shrank away from it, the horrible stuff, with something very near to panic. I only took two backward steps, and then I bumped into something that made muffled sounds to match my own panic. Deborah. I ripped the duct tape off her mouth. "Jesus Christ, that hurt," she said. "For God's sake, let me out of this shit and quit acting like a fucking lunatic." I looked down at Deborah. The tape had left a ring of blood around the outside of her lips, awful red blood that drove me back behind my eyes and into the yesterday box with Mommy. And she lay there, just like Mommy. Just like last time, with the cool air of the box lifting the hair on my neck and the dark shadows chattering around us. Just exactly like last time, and the way she lay there all taped and staring and waiting like some kind of... "God damn it!" she said. "Come on, Dex. Snap out of it." And yet, this time, I had a knife. And she was still helpless. And I could change everything now. I could... "Dexter?" said Mommy. I mean, Deborah. Of course, that's what I meant. Not Mommy at all, who had left us here in this same place, just like this. Left us in this place where it began, and now might finally finish. With a burning, absolutely must-do-it-already on its large, dark horse, and galloping along under the wonderful moon, and the 1,000 intimate voices whispering, "Do it. Do it now. Do it, and everything can change the way it should be. Back with..." "Mommy?" someone said. "Dexter, come on," said Mommy. I mean, Deborah. But the knife was moving. "Dexter, for Christ's sake, cut the shit. It's me, Debbie." I shook my head, and of course it was Deborah. But I couldn't stop the knife. "I know, Deb. I'm really very sorry." The knife crept higher. I could only watch it. Couldn't stop it now for anything. One small spiderweb touch of Harry still whipped at me, demanding that I pay attention and get squared away. But it was so small and weak, and the need was big, strong, stronger than it had ever been before. Because this was everything, the beginning and the end, and it lifted me up and out of myself and sent me washing away down the tunnel between the boy and the blood and the last chance to make it right. This would change everything, would pay back Mommy, would show her what she had done. Because Mommy should have saved us, and this time had to be different. Even Deb had to see that. "Put the knife down, Dexter." Her voice was a little calmer now, but those other voices were so much louder that I could barely hear her. I tried to put the knife down, really, I did, but I only managed to lower it a few inches. "I'm sorry, Deb. I just can't," I said, fighting to speak at all with the rising howl around me of the storm that had built for 25 years, and now with my brother and me brought together like thunderheads on a dark and moony night. "Dexter," said Wicked Mommy, who wanted to leave us here alone in the awful cold blood, and the voice of my brother inside hissed out with mine, "Bitch!" And the knife went all the way back up. A noise came from the floor. La Guerta? I couldn't tell, and it didn't matter. I had to finish. Had to do this. Had to let this happen now. "Dexter," Debbie said, "I'm your sister. You don't want to do this to me. What would Daddy say?" And that hurt, I'll admit it, but "put down the knife, Dexter." Another sound behind me, and a small gurgle.
The knife in my hand went up.
"Dexter, look out!"
Deborah said, and I turned. Detective LaGuerta was on one knee, gasping, straining to raise her suddenly very heavy weapon. Up came the barrel, slowly, slowly, pointed at my foot, my knee. But did it matter? Because this was going to happen now, no matter what, and even though I could see LaGuerta's finger tighten on the trigger, the knife in my hand didn't even slow down.
"She's going to shoot you, Dex!"
Deb called, sounding somewhat frantic now, and the gun was pointed at my navel. LaGuerta's face was screwing itself into a frown of tremendous concentration and effort, and she really was going to shoot me. I half-turned toward LaGuerta, but my knife was still fighting its way down toward...
"Dexter!"
said Mommy Deborah on the table, but the dark passenger called louder and moved forward, grabbing my hand and guiding the knife down.
"Dex!"
"You're a good kid, Dex,"
whispered Harry from behind in his feather-hard ghost voice, just enough to twitch the knife so very little up again.
"I can't help it,"
I whispered back, so very much growing into the handle of the quivering blade.
"Choose what or who you kill,"
he said with the hard and endless blue of his eyes, now watching me from Deborah's same eyes, watching now loud enough to push the knife a full half inch away.
"There are plenty of people who deserve it,"
said Harry, so softly above the rising, angry yammer of the stampede inside. The tip of the knife winked and froze in place. The dark passenger could not send it down. Harry could not pull it away. And there we were. Behind me I heard a rasping sound, a heavy thump, and then a moan so very full of emptiness that it crawled across my shoulders like a silk scarf on spider legs. I turned. LaGuerta lay with her gun hand stretched out, pinned to the floor by Brian's knife, her lower lip trapped between her teeth and her eyes alive with pain. Brian crouched beside her, watching the fear scamper across her face. He was breathing hard through a dark smile.
"Shall we clean up, brother?" he said.
"I can't," I said.
My brother lurched to his feet and stood in front of me, weaving slightly from side to side.
"Can't," he said. "I don't think I know that word."
He pried the knife from my fingers, and I couldn't stop him, and I couldn't help him. His eyes were on Deborah now, but his voice whipped across me and blasted at the phantom hairy fingers on my shoulder.
"Must, little brother. Absolutely must. No other way."
He gasped and bent double for a moment, slowly straightening, slowly raising the knife.
"Do I have to remind you of the importance of family?"
"No," I said. With both my families, living and dead, crowded around me, clamoring for me to do and not do. And with one last whisper from the hairy blue eyes of my memory, my head began to shake all by itself, and I said it again. "No," and this time I meant it. "No, I can't. Not Deborah." My brother looked at me.
"Too bad," he said. "I'm so disappointed."
And the knife came down. Epilogue. I know it's a nearly human weakness, and it may be no more than ordinary sentimentality, but I have always loved funerals. For one thing, they're so clean, so neat, so completely given over to careful ceremonies. And this was really a very good one. It had rows of blue-uniformed policemen and women, looking solemn and neat and, well, ceremonial. There was the ritual salute with the guns, the careful folding of the flag, all the trimmings, a proper and wonderful show for the deceased. She had been, after all, one of our own, a woman who had served with the few, the proud. Or is that the Marines? No matter. She had been a Miami cop, and Miami cops know how to throw a funeral for one of their own.
They have had so much practice.
Oh, Deborah, I sighed, very softly.
And of course I knew she couldn't hear me, but it really did seem like the right thing to do. And I wanted to do this right. I almost wished I could summon up a tear or two to wipe away. She and I had been very close. And it had been a messy and unpleasant death. No way for a cop to go. Hacked to death by a homicidal maniac. Rescue had come too late. It was all over long before anyone could get to her. And yet, by her example of selfless courage, she had helped to show how a cop should live and die. I'm quoting, of course, but that's the gist of it. Really very good stuff. Quite moving if one has anything inside that can be moved. Which I don't. But I know it when I hear it, and this was the real thing. And very much caught up in the silent bravery of the officers in their clean blues and the weeping of the civilians, I couldn't help myself. I sighed heavily. Oh, Deborah, I sighed. A little louder this time, almost feeling it. Dear, dear Deborah.
Quiet, you moron,
she whispered, and poked me hard with her elbow. She looked lovely in her new outfit, a sergeant at last. The least they could do for her, after all her hard work identifying and nearly catching the Tamiami slasher. With the APB out on him, no doubt they would find my poor brother, sooner or later, if he didn't find them first, of course. Since I had just been reminded so forcefully that family is important, I did hope he could stay free. And Deborah would come around, now that she had accepted her promotion. She really wanted to forgive me, and she was already more than half convinced of the wisdom of Harry. We were family, too, and that had shown in the end, hadn't it? It was not such a great leap to accept me as I was, after all, was it? Things being what they are. What they have, in fact, always been. I sighed again.
Quit it,
she hissed, and nodded at the far end of the line of stiff Miami cops. I glanced where she indicated. Sergeant Doakes glared at me. He hadn't taken his eyes off me, not once the whole time, even when he had dropped his handful of earth on Detective LaGuerta's coffin. He was so very sure that things were not what they seemed. I knew with a total certainty that he would come for me now, track me like the hound he was, snort at my footsteps and sniff my back trail and hunt me down, bring me to bay for what I had done and what I would quite naturally do again. I squeezed my sister's hand, and with my other hand, I fingered the cool, hard edge of the glass slide in my pocket. One small drop of dried blood that would not go into the grave with LaGuerta, but live forever on my shelf. It gave me comfort, and I didn't mind Sergeant Doakes, or whatever he thought or did. How could I mind? He could no more control who he was and what he did than anyone else could. He would come for me. Truly, what else could he do? What can any of us do? Helpless as we all are, in the grip of our own little voices, what indeed can we do? I really wished I could shed a tear. It was all so beautiful. As beautiful as the next full moon would be, when I would call on Sergeant Doakes. And things would go on as they were, as they had always been, beneath that lovely, bright moon. The wonderful, fat, musical, red moon.
The End. You've been listening to Darkly Dreaming Dexter by Jeff Lindsay, narrated by Nick Landrum. If you've enjoyed this book and this performance, Recorded Books recommends Twisted by Jeffrey Deaver, narrated by Christine McMurdo Wallace, Richard Ferrone, Tom Stekschulte, and Pete Bradbury. Jeffrey Deaver is a world-renowned author, well known for his best-selling Lincoln Rhyme thrillers. Collected here are 16 short stories, each displaying his uncanny knack for keeping his readers guessing till the end and glued to their seats. Also included is a brand new Lincoln Rhymes story exclusive to this collection. Tom Steckschulte, Pete Bradbury, Christine McMurdo Wallace, and Richard Ferrone lend their formidable voices to Deaver's colorful characters and help heighten the suspense in each tale. We also recommend Slab Rat by Ted Heller, narrated by Johnny Heller. This story of the glossy magazine industry has won critical acclaim for its wicked humor and unflinching examination of New York City's slab rats, who will stop at nothing to climb the corporate ladder. Zach Post is an editor for It Magazine, with an impressive history. His father is a famous architect, his mother a socialite, and he has attended Colgate, Berkeley, and Liverpool University. Or at least that's what everyone thinks. When obnoxious new editor Mark Larkin is quickly promoted, Zach's secrets are threatened, and his future no longer seems bright. But he knows what to do. Mark Larkin must be eliminated. Ted Heller draws from his experience with a variety of magazines to write a slick, hilarious exposé of the industry. Johnny Heller's narration captures all the biting wit of this fresh, clever satire. You'll find a wide selection of titles in the Recorded Books catalog, including bestsellers, mysteries, classics, histories, and more. So, to order another recorded book or for a copy of our latest listing, please call the toll-free number found on the back of this book. Don't forget to ask about easy 30-day rentals by mail. On our website, you can browse our catalog, place orders, hear about our latest releases, or tune in to narrator profiles and author interviews. So visit us there at www.recordedbooks.com. And thank you for being a Recorded Books reader.